The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Welcome back, everyone. My name is Renee Powers, and I'm absolutely giddy about this episode today. If you listened to my February reading wrap-up, What Renee Read in February, that was the most recent episode, I gushed about the book We Ride Upon Styx by Quan Berry. And today, I am sharing my conversation with the author, so stay tuned for that. I usually have a whole spiel to begin every podcast episode, but if you're listening, you know what's going on. Everything is happening. We have a ton of events coming up this month and all the way through the end of May. I encourage you to browse our website. The homepage got a facelift. Feministbookclub.com. There you can find all of our events. You can read a little bit more about us. We do have a pretty thorough FAQ page. You can see what's new and cool in our shop. You can listen to these podcast episodes and read the show notes very easily. You can get on our email list, and that will give you a sweet discount and first dibs on everything. So that's it. That's all I got today. I hope you enjoy today's interview, and if you pick up this book, I hope you are as obsessed with it as I am. Enjoy. Welcome back, everyone. Today I am chatting with Quan Berry. Quan is a poet and novelist. She's the author of 4 books of poetry, most recently Loose Strife, as well as the novel She Weeps Each Time You're Born. Berry teaches at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where she directs the Institute for Creative Writing. And today we are talking about her brand new novel, We Ride Upon Styx. Welcome.
Fabulous. Thanks for having me.
I'm really excited to talk about this book. But my first question is always, what is your definition of feminism?
So in thinking about it, I think too many people, when they think of feminism, they think that that means the idea of women, quote unquote, being on top of the hierarchy. And to me, the thought that I've always had in mind when I think of what feminism means, it's the idea of dismantling traditional hierarchies, gender hierarchies for all of us, so that we're all free to be who we want to be, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not about the idea of having women on top. It's the idea that through empowering women to fully be who they are, it helps all of us then be our true selves.
Right. It goes back to rising tides lift all boats. If there's room at the top for all of us, shine theory, et cetera, et cetera. But we can talk about it till we're blue in the face, but it's until we actually do something about it to break down systemic barriers, we're kind of all screwed until then.
Yeah. And I think, you know, so men who sometimes are afraid of the label, it's the idea of realizing that, again, that it helps them, you know? So think about men who aren't allowed to show certain kinds of emotions in public, or who aren't allowed to dress certain kinds of ways, or who aren't allowed to go into certain kinds of academic fields or, you know, professional fields. It's the idea, again, that the more gender freedom we all have, like I said, it just serves everybody. So that's what I think.
Absolutely. I love that definition. How do you think that applies to your most recent, your brand new book, We Ride Upon Styx?
So the book is about, it's set in the 1980s. It's about a group of young women in high school who were part of a field hockey team on the North Shore of Boston, and who basically, various things happen, and they end up using witchcraft in order to win games in order to make it to the state championship by the end of the season. And so in thinking about feminism, you know, when I was writing the book, I was very interested in looking at stories which are typically thought of as being sort of like men's domain. So, for example, my very first book, She Weeps Each Time You're Born, is set in Vietnam. And usually when, you know, we hear about the novels about Vietnam, the stories about Vietnam, we assume that they're about men. We assume that they're about American men during the war, you know, what have you. So I was really interested in writing a book about Vietnam, but from a woman's perspective and from a Vietnamese woman's perspective. And so in thinking about this book, I've always been interested in the idea of team sports. But generally speaking, team sports are thought of as being, again, sort of men's territory. You know, we're familiar with Friday Night Lights. I was just at the movies just this weekend. There's a new basketball movie coming out with Ben Affleck. You know, he's the coach of a renegade team or what have you, you know. So, again, sports movies are usually thought of as being sort of a boys thing. And I was interested in, well, what would happen, you know, if I wrote a book that was a girls' team? What kinds of issues would come up? What kinds of issues would the team face? I was just interested in thinking about that in general. And so in doing that, I was also interested because the book takes place in the 1980s when we were not as sophisticated as early as we are now, and sort of rethinking some of those received archetypes about characters in the 1980s and about stories, about what girls were allowed to be or what they weren't allowed to be. You know, if you think about any of those John Hughes movies, you know, it's like there's only certain kinds of roles that women fill in those movies, even if they're the main character. And so, like I said, I was interested in going back into that time and thinking these things. And I think that by doing that, so what makes the book feminist at heart is it's these women who are interested in just being authentically whoever they are. One of the things that I was also interested in is, you know, growing up in the 1980s, my mother and my grandmother, I love them very much, but it's true that I oftentimes would hear the word like ladylike. You know, they would say to me like, that's not very ladylike. And, you know, they never said things about being gentlemanly to my brothers, you know? And so in this book, I am interested in characters who consciously or unconsciously, you know, aren't really interested in being ladylike and are more interested in just being themselves. And I think that for all of us, again, it's a very feminist project.
Yes. And these characters are still so developed and complicated and are still concerned about their hair, make it as big as possible, and their glitter eyeshadow. Some of them don't give a rat's ass, right? But I thought that the characters were so, I wanted to be on this team. And I know that this is a real team, correct?
It is, yeah.
So what made you decide to choose this team, this story, this era?
So Danvers is an actual town on the North Shore of Boston. It's about 17 miles north of the city. Back in 1692, the town of Salem, the city of Salem, was much bigger than it is currently. And so Danvers was actually part of Salem. And Danvers back in 1692 was known as Salem Village. And a lot of the initial happenings that spurred the Salem witch trials actually began in the town of Danvers. So a lot of the teen girls who first accused people of being witches, a lot of them were actually from Danvers. The meeting house, the parsonage where the reverend lived, that's actually in Danvers. You can just see like the outlines of the foundation. The house itself is gone. But again, that was all part of Danvers. And so I myself grew up in Danvers. And so I always was familiar with the history and the Salem witch trials and what that meant and where that happened. And I myself played field hockey in 1989. And our team did very well and made it to the state championship. Been thinking about it, you know, when I first started thinking about the story, I actually thought that I was going to set it in Salem. It was going to be the action, because the name of the sports teams in Salem, they're actually called the Witches. And so I thought, oh, okay, maybe, you know, the book will actually follow the Witches, it'll be in Salem. And I was talking to another friend of mine who's also from the same area, and she was like, well, why not just set it in Danvers, just talk about the history, like what Danvers was and what happened there and that kind of stuff. And I thought about it and I was like, yeah, you know, first of all, I mean, I know Salem pretty well, but I didn't grow up there. So I don't know little things like the name of the corner store or where the gas stations were, or that kind of stuff. But I'm like, I know all of that stuff about Danvers and the fact that Danvers is where it all started. So she was right. Like, why not actually set the book in Danvers rather than trying to set it in Salem? So I followed her advice. And once I did that, it was a fun book to write. It was pretty easy to write in the sense that I didn't have to do a lot of research. My mom is really good friends with our town archivist, a man named Richard Trask, who has his office in the Danvers Public Library. You know, I emailed him a couple of times to ask, you know, a couple of questions about things. But by and large, I knew the characters. I had a feel for the town or for the era. So that's the reason why I decided to start writing.
Okay, that puts a whole new perspective on it, because I didn't realize that's where you were from. I had read your biography that you grew up near Boston. I didn't realize that you played field hockey, that you were part of this 1989 team.
I feel so just enchanted by all of that information because it's a very enchanting book. I told you before we started recording, as soon as I put it down, I said out loud, that's the best book I've read in a long time. And I read a lot of books. I found it. It was one of those books that I wanted to sit down and read in all of my time. I just wanted to dedicate all of my time to it. And I think one of the reasons was how absolutely delightful the era of big hair, you know, neon colors, all of the 80s and, well, I think they're all class of 1990, right? But this 80s feeling of it was so immersive, and I wanted to spend more time there. I grew up in Northern Indiana. We got all of the 80s trends a few years later, and so that was like my childhood. I'm a child of the 90s, but it still felt so familiar. That's just me gushing. I want to talk about their use of magic. I describe this on Goodreads as the perfect mix of Now and Then, Pretty in Pink, and Practical Magic, because these girls are all doing some practical magic to get them to state championships. Tell our listeners what the magic, well, first off, who is at the center of the magic? Who is kind of their icon? And then what they do, how that influences their gameplay.
So in many ways, I'll say a couple of things before I get to the magic stuff, but one has to do with the idea of place. So as I just mentioned, the idea that Dan was an actual place. And it was really important to me that everything, I mean like everything in the book, when it comes to place or location, is basically, it's 97% accurate. Like there are very few places that I made up. So for example, the name of the bowling alley, that's the actual bowling alley. The name of the mall, the name of the stores in the mall, you know, many of which don't exist anymore, obviously. You know, when they go to downtown Danvers and they go to various restaurants, like those all exist. And so place is like a super important in the book as far as that's concerned. As far as the magic stuff goes, I think of it as sort of DIY. You know, they're just trying to figure it out on their own. They don't actually have any models for who to refer to. You know, it all starts when the goalie just decides that she's going to take this Emilio Estevez notebook and write a letter to like the dark powers that be to ask for help.
It's so good.
In many ways, like I said, they're just figuring it out as they go. You know, one of my favorite chapters is the chapter where they actually go to Salem for Halloween and they actually end up visiting a Wiccan shop. It was important for me to also include aspects and just give a little bit of history about Wiccans and pagans and what the difference is and who they are and what they believe and those kinds of things. Sadly, it's very true that in the early 90s, I remember being in Salem in Halloween and that there were people at the parade, you know, throwing eggs at people who were Wiccans. So it was basically the Wiccans were marching from downtown Salem, maybe to Gallo Sale. I can't remember where they were marching to, but that there were, even in the early 90s, people who were against them. And that's not true, but it was true back then. And so, like I said, the team is really just sort of cobbling together their own brand of ways of empowering themselves. And in many ways, you know, what they're doing is really they're sort of unleashing their just who they truly are, you know? So they think of it in terms of that they have to do all these sort of like mischievous things in order to have power or what have you. But it turns out, well, maybe that's actually just who they are. It's what they're really, you know, unleashing is their own inner power as opposed to some sort of dark power. So that's what they're up to. I think a lot of it is just kind of based on things that, you know, kids do. So I remember as a child, you know, that was trying to do that. It's like light as a feather, stick as a board, you know, your little kid. Or sometimes, you know, little kid with your friends, you go into a bathroom and turn off all the lights and look into the mirror and try and say something like Bloody Mary or things like that. And so, you know, we were always trying to come up with our own ways of conjuring whatever it was, that whatever powers we thought were possible, you know. And that's kind of what they're up to as well. I'll just say one more thing too, which is not related to the magic aspect of it, but you mentioned, you know, the characters in the 80s and all those kind of fun things. It's also important to me that the book has a lot of social criticism in it in many ways. And so, you know, each chapter we see a different player and we see the different issues that affect her life. And so I like to think of it, I have this joke, in many ways the book is kind of like a green smoothie. You know, in the sense that oftentimes with green smoothies, like there's spinach in it, but you can't really taste the spinach. So even though there's a lot of social criticism in the book, you know, there's criticism about race. You know, of the team, there's 11-person team. There are 3 people on the team who are girls of color, you know, and just what that's like for them. You know, there are characters who maybe are LGBTQIA, you know, there's all these kinds of things. So even though the book is a comedy, and that's definitely where it's positioned, like I said, there's still social commentary that's in there. one point they talk about how, you know, Reagan, he's no longer president, but he had been president, and what that meant for certain groups to have Reagan as a president, and what it meant for other groups or what have you. So, like I said, there's other stuff in there besides just the comedy too.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you brought that up, because that's a great metaphor, the green smoothie, because it's still situated in the late 80s, in that the criticism is also kind of late 80s criticism. Like, this is Reagan's America still, and these are the critiques that we're bringing up about capitalism and individualism and all these neoliberalism. But it's, again, couched in a way that is, I guess, like you said, like, easy to digest, easy to relate to, because the characters are so full and vibrant and fun that it's not dogmatic, or it doesn't feel like a teaching moment, but you can recognize, oh, this is what was going on then. And even the language that they use too is there's some slang and some racial epithets that we would not use today. And so I thought it was really tastefully done, because recently I've read some things that hasn't been tastefully done. I thought that was really well done. But I want to talk about the humor part of it, because your previous work has not been comedy, and this is a laugh out loud kind of book. Every page you're actually laughing your ass off. So tell me about your range as an author, what that has meant for you, and how you've approached different genres, really.
So when I was a kid, when I used to think about wanting to be a writer, that's what I wanted to be. I wanted to be a writer. I didn't want to be a poet. I didn't want to be a fiction writer. I didn't want to be a playwright. As a child, I just did all that stuff. I didn't really realize there were differences, you know, between those things. And so it's only now as an adult, you know, as a professor in the creative writing program, that I see this idea that the academy in general, you know, we have all these specialists, but in many ways, writers and artists are sort of the last generalists in it. So it's true, like, not to brag, but I know like a lot of stuff, but I only know a little bit about a lot of stuff, as opposed to being a specialist in something who knows a ton about one subject, right? And so my poetry is very serious, you know, just a lot of current topics, ideas of trauma, historical trauma, all those kinds of things. I guess it could be a good exercise for me to ever think about, like, what would that look like if I were to write a funny poem? But as of right now, and I have 4 books of poetry, I haven't felt the need to write a funny poem. And to be quite honest, like, I'm not sure I could write a funny poem. And so when I went to write my first novel, again, which was set in Vietnam, it made sense that that book would be sort of a ghost story, the ghosts of Vietnam sort of telling their stories of what happened to them and things like that. So obviously in the telling of that story, it was obvious to me that I would rely more on my poetic language and on my skills as a poet to actually tell that story. And thinking about when I sat down to write this book, it very, very quickly became obvious to me that it was a comedy. Just the combination of things, the 80s, field hockey, you know, witchcraft. I just knew that it was going to be a funny book. Again, like I said, pretty early on into the process. And it's allowed me to do things in my writing which I haven't been able to do previously in other works. In my regular life, like, people who know me, like, you know, I took, like, even before writing this book, I took a couple of, you know, improv comedy classes, and I have friends who've done that, and we're pretty funny. You know, my dad's funny, one of my brothers is really funny. But like I said, I had never had an opportunity to sort of show that in my work. And so even though it wasn't like a conscious decision, like, I am going to consciously write a funny book, just sort of worked that way. And I will say too that I didn't read a lot of comedic works before I started writing the book, but I would look specifically at women's books, you know, that were supposed to be funny. And I have to admit, and I won't use it, you know, throw anybody under the bus, but I didn't find a lot of women's works to be actually funny. And I think what was happening is that a lot of the books that I looked at, or I mentioned a lot, but a few of the books that I looked at, the ways in which they were funny is that they were quote unquote situationally funny. Like, oh no, I have a first date and I burned the roast. You know what I mean? It was like situational humor, as opposed to the humor sort of being baked into the language. And I'm much more interested in the humor, and both kind of situational, you know, humor. I could be interested in that, but I'm also just interested in just the language itself and how you can tell a funny story, again, just through your word choice and things like that. One of my favorite authors is somebody who, I don't know if he's out of favor. He's an old white British guy, and I'm sure he has said many things that people probably do not agree with, but I have to admit that I love Martin Amis. Martin Amis, his great love, literally, is Vladimir Nabokov, however you want to pronounce it. And when you look back at them, and like Lolita, which is obviously a very sad work, it's also very funny. you know? And again, the humor in it though comes just like in a turn of phrase and how things are described. I should really go back and look it up, but for example, Martin Amis, I very rarely laugh when I actually read books, but Martin Amis is one of the few people that actually make me laugh. And I'm going to mangle this, it's not even close to being what it is. I don't really want to sound super political, but Martin Amis has a couple of essays about politics in the United States. And there's just one essay where he describes Mitt Romney as always looking like he has the pained smile of a man with a sore shoulder who's just shrugged his way into a too tight dinner jacket. Yeah, every time he smiles, it always looks like just slightly painful, like, oh, my shoulder, you know what I mean? And again, it's not exactly the quote, but it has to do with that. It's just so funny to me because I'm like, it's spot on, you know what I mean? And so again, when it comes to humor, that's more what I was going for.
And it's not out of place either, because teenagers can be really, really funny. And they all have unique senses of humor, and we learn their voices. I can imagine that spending time with these characters was just a delight. I would love to know what it was like writing these characters. Do you have like big dossiers for each one, or did they just kind of come to you as you were writing?
Yeah, I'm not the kind of writer as of right now who ever keeps notes on anything. I also don't even keep drafts by and large. I just write over stuff. So when the book's finished, it's like there's just like really only one copy of it in many ways. And so the thing about these characters, there's at the beginning of the book, there's a graph that shows you like, you know, if you were to outline what the team looks like and where their positions are. So it's a graph of a field hockey field, and you see the different players, where they play on the field. And so when I first started writing it, I maybe was just thinking just like broadly, like, okay, this character is sort of the it girl, the beautiful, rich, you know, whatever, and this character is what have you. But I discovered with very quickly that initially too many of them had names that ended in Y. You know, it's like Pammy and Tammy and Amy and Christy and but I mean, I was like, oh my God. So I had to go back. And in some ways, like in renaming them, it kind of helped really sort of, that's when I knew who they were, when I renamed them and their positions. And it's true, like I said, so I was thinking in terms of just like archetypes, but how to move beyond archetypes. So again, you have like the tomboy, you know, you have the bubbly go-getter who is always optimistic. You know, you have the rich girl, you know, you have the this, you have the that. So I thought about those archetypes, but I wanted to push them further. But no, I didn't have any kind of big dossier on all of them. It just became pretty apparent pretty quickly, like who they were.
Do you have a favorite? You don't have to tell me, but do you have a favorite that you like to write?
The chapters, she's not necessarily my favorite character, but I have to admit my chapter that was the most fun was the chapter where they go to Salem. I just found that chapter a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. They show up and the other team is in actual witches' hats, including the refs. So good. So good. Okay, so this is ostensibly a book about a girls' field hockey team. I love sports, so I loved that aspect of it. But just as, and you mentioned Friday Night Lights earlier, is a show that's not really about football, this is a book that's not really about field hockey. So who is this book for?
Yeah, people have asked, like, is it young adults? And I'm like, no. That's not to say that people who are young adults couldn't enjoy it, but that's not who I wrote it for. I almost think of it in terms of like the TV show, The Wonder Years. So The Wonder Years, which was on in like the 80s and the 90s, I mean, it was about kids from the 1960s, but that was not a kid's show, you know what I mean? And so in many ways, the book is, I mean, there's obviously Gen Xers will get a lot out of it because the references, they'll know probably in their entirety, Gen X women in particular. But having said that, because the 80s are back with a vengeance, you know, I do think younger audience can also get a lot out of it as well. And I do think, because people tend to think, oh, women, it's a women's book, it's about women's field hockey team. I think actually, you know, college age kids, maybe even a little bit younger, particularly, and also men, because the ways in which the book talks about things like consent and talks about other issues that are facing women, I think it could be a good way for young men to have conversations, thinking about the kinds of issues facing women, thinking about where they are, where they themselves, men, fit into these conversations. So one of my local booksellers here, I found out from him that he loved the book. He's this, you know, white guy in his 60s. And again, he's like my biggest fan, which is crazy to me. You know?
No. He can fight me. I'm your biggest fan right now.
So I think in that sense, I think the story, even though it's particular to a particular time, the story itself is universal enough that I think it can reverberate with all kinds of people. So I don't want to, you know, because obviously there was a lot of stuff in the press you know, in the last couple of months about Little Women and about how men wouldn't go see Little Women because it was seen always being, you know, a movie for women. I don't think this book, I think it's for anybody who likes to laugh. Yeah, I just think it's a comedy.
One of the things I loved about it too is there are a lot of references to The Crucible. And that was a show I did in high school. And I saw the version of your book I have is a galley. And at the beginning, there's a letter from your editor, Deborah Garrison. And she says, and you mentioned this as well in the book, but the quirky title is an actual quote from an enslaved woman named Tituba from her trial for witchcraft in Salem in 1692. And Tituba is a main character in The Crucible. And the Danvers High School Drama Club's play this year is what else? The Crucible. I just thought you couldn't write that. Like, that is so perfect. The one question I have about that, as I was reading it, I realized there are some names I recognize in here. Obviously, Abby Putnam. Putnam is a character of The Crucible. But also, you've got Girl Corey and Boy Corey. And one of the characters in The Crucible is Giles Corey. Is that a play on that?
So the Putnam definitely is.
Yes.
Because again, she's a descendant of Ann Putnam. So that's definitely there. As far as the girl Corey and the boy Corey go, I mean, I thought about it afterwards, but I knew somebody, and in his circle of friends, there was a girl Corey and a boy Corey. And that's how they referred to them to the street. Like, it was boy Corey. Oh, wait, what's Corey? Oh, it's Corey. I just thought that was funny.
It is funny.
Yeah, and nowadays it wouldn't be that big a deal because you have so many more names that are unisex like that. But again, 1989, that really wasn't the case.
So one of the things I loved about the book is the way that it ends. And did you always know that, I'm not going to spoil it, but did you always know that this is where you were going with it as you were writing it?
No. So again, I'm somebody who I don't plan things out. I just have everything usually thought through in my head before I start. Having said that, I've only written two novels. So it's not to say that maybe with my next novel, I would sit down and have a huge graph and know everything there is to know about it. But I basically like to write my way into corners and then have to write my way out. And so, I mean, I knew that I was writing towards, just not a spoiler alert, because you find it out in chapter one that they want to get to the state championship. So I knew I was writing my way towards that. And then the question was going to become, well, how to resolve this? Like, what's going to happen at the state championship? How are we going to find out? How's it all going to play out? And I was definitely thinking in terms of, you know, because there's a lot of balls in the air as the book is going that can meet each character in her own chapter, and she has her own stuff going on. And so I knew that I was going to have to hopefully satisfactorily wrap up, give everybody like a complete arc in a certain kind of way. And so I didn't know exactly where we would end up in doing that, but I knew that I had to do it. And so the ending that I decided on was an ending that allowed me to give that kind of closure.
And it felt really good. It felt really right. So hopefully this interview wraps up really right too. So is there anything that we didn't get to that you want to talk about?
You know, the 80s are just so interesting to me, the whole concept of nostalgia, right? And not to end on like a negative note, but I've been talking with a lot of friends about like, what is it about the power of nostalgia? You know, just even thinking about like politically, like why certain people are drawn to certain kinds of politics is because they think that somehow something is better X number of years ago, you know what I mean? And so I think that this book is just an example of how nostalgia can be a positive thing, that it can hopefully, we can learn from it. We can be nostalgic for the past, that we can learn that the past wasn't perfect. And we can take our knowledge of that and see who we were and take it into the present and grow and become better people. So like I said, hopefully the book, many lessons to be learned, a lot of fun along the way, and all that kind of fun stuff. So thanks.
Thank you. So the last questions I wrap up with is, I know you're not on social media, but I know you're going on tour. So if we want to keep up where you're going to be on tour, is there some place we can go check those dates?
So yes. Yeah, it's true. Okay. Social media and I are not friends, but so if you actually do a search for me, it's a little involved, sorry, but if you do a search for me, so at the Penguin Random House website, so if you actually go to their website and you actually type in my name in the book, it would come up, you would see my book, you would see my previous book with them, again, at the Penguin Random House website, and then right beside my name, or right beside the book title, it says On Tour, and if you click on Tour, it will show you all the places that I'll be at.
Awesome. I will put up direct link to that in the show notes to make that easy on everyone. And I'm looking forward to possibly seeing you here in Minneapolis at the end of March, and you'll be back here at Wordplay at the beginning of May, which Feminist Book Club will be at as well. So that's very exciting. And the final question is, if you have a book to recommend that is not your own, what would that be?
Yeah. So there was a book that came out, I think it was 2018, called August Town. by a Jamaican British author named Kei Miller, K-E-I Miller. It's an amazing book about the history, a very specific history in Jamaica, which I didn't know much about. I didn't in some ways know the history of the Rastafarians. So the book is actually much broader than that, but you do get a history of the Rastafarians in it. It's just, it's beautifully written. In many ways, if I had an author to recommend, he would be the author. People just don't know him. Again, I think in Britain he's known, but he hasn't quite made the transatlantic transition quite yet. So hopefully, I hope he will, because he's just an amazing author.
Excellent. I'll link that in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Fabulous. Great. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.